Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Back with me in the studios of CBS Interactive today, podcast regular Paul Robinson.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Paul's boss of Kids Co. and Mumbrella deputy editor Robin Hicks.
Hello, Tim.
This week, Kentucky Fried Arteries meet the double. Is it a PR nightmare or great free media? Radio ratings, winners and losers. IPTV, the teleprogramming of tomorrow. Clarkson and Friends miss a gear at 9. And Conference Corner, we're at Astra and AdTech. Now, Paul, welcome back to Australia, and I think we can start calling you a podcast regular now. This must be at least your third visit, I think.
I think I've done four now.
Right, this is four, is it?
Yeah, so it's always nice to come in the studio, and I have to say, the studio is looking fantastic.
Yes, it's getting tidied up and slightly more professional stands.
Very, very nice. Yeah, yes. No, it's impressive.
And you're in Australia every 6 months, effectively.
Yeah, twice a year, two or three times a year, yeah.
This time you're here for the Astra Conference, you're waving the flag for Kids Co. How is business at Kids Co? What's changed since we last chatted?
Well, it's good. I think what we've done in the last few months has been increasing the amount of exclusive and original content. And I think as part of the overall strategy for subscription television, what's critical is that subscription television convinces people that it's offering things that free TV doesn't. And so you don't want content that's actually windowed on free TV. So we've launched a number of shows. I mean, Turbo Dogs in January, Bommy and Friends in February, then Pippi Longstocking in March. And in fact, in April, from April 4, Boo and Me Season 2, which is an original production. Again, you know, exclusive first run on subscription TV, no free TV window.
And how many of these are ones that you've commissioned yourself?
Roughly half are commissioned, half are original production. We're doing more and more original production, and we may talk about that later. But the reason, really, is aside from that reason, it's also to get into podcasting, into iPads, mobiles, video on demand. The rights are sometimes nightmarish when you're dealing with big rights owners. If you own the production, you've got it throughout every window, every device, whether invented or not, and it just makes it much easier.
And is your strategy usually to get hold of content that you can actually run across all of your different territories?
We try to. I mean, there are those rights holders, though, who don't either know the value of their rights and try and charge you too much, or just can't cope with selling you the rights, or it's just too complicated. So there's still a lot of work to do with certain rights holders who don't get the new future you're moving into. But if it's your own stuff, it's just so easy.
Well, the session that you were on at Astro, I think one of the topics was connecting with the audience beyond the TV screen, which you're sort of hinting at there. Is that how the future looks?
I think that children are very interesting because they are totally expecting you to be able to connect via any screen. It's not like this is something special. It's like, why is it not on my iPad? And kids have got iPads, you know, they've got lots of iPads. Why is it not on my mobile phone? You know, why can't I have full forward, fast forward, you know, functionality on this? They sort of expect it. So, you know, kids are multitaskers. They're using all these devices. They're completely unfazed by technology. So as a kids broadcaster, we have to be everywhere. And then the other part of that, of course, is leveraging the power of the internet and this whole debate about what you do regarding services such as YouTube and Netflix and Love Film and how these things integrate with more traditional broadcasting. And they're both opportunity and threat for platforms like Foxtel and Austar.
Now, one of the things that I know we've talked about this before, it strikes me that kids are also becoming more media savvy as right. well. At the moment, you don't have advertising on the TV side of things. Will that have to change in time? Is that a logical thing to do?
No, I don't think so, actually. I mean, I think kids are pretty literate and they do understand when they're being advertised to and when they're actually having editorial. But it's more about offering an alternative again. You know, if you look at 7910 Network, they are ad-funded networks. And there are parents who would prefer their children not to be exposed to advertising. You know, we'll talk about it in a minute, about, you know, the effects of maybe fast food, for example. But there's also the sort of the pressure that comes from kids sometimes. You know, if you are maybe in a tight budget, and hey, we've all had, you know, lean times the last couple of years for the GFC. If a child is, you know, demanding something because it's seen the ad on TV, it puts a lot of pressure on parents. And some parents don't want that. So an ad-free service is a differentiator compared to free TV, and therefore we're going to continue with an ad-free service.
Now, Robin, you were at Astra as well. What were the main messages that
you
took?
Yeah, it was interesting. Well, I think the most interesting thing that Paul's actually touched on it there is how to integrate social media with mainstream traditional broadcasting. And I put a question to Mark Fennessy, who's CEO of Shine Productions.
So they're the people behind things like, they're just about to take on the MasterChef production over here and a couple of the big game shows and
right,
that sort of thing.
Yes, and he strongly hinted that they would, within months, I'm quoting him, start to look at how to integrate social media into new and existing programming. Which I thought was very interesting. But I think it's very much easier said than done. There's quite a lot of posturing. I'm not sure that actually we'll see new programmes integrate Facebook or Twitter, live streaming social media into programming quite yet.
I suppose that one of the questions is how you, whether it drives you to do more live programming, for instance, in order to make social media, you know, work within it.
Well, I think that what we are going to get to, and I agree with you completely, is people will watch linear television, and linear television is not dead. You know, the linear TV on the main room in the living room is going to continue for a long, long time. But the chance to maybe talk about a show with your friends, you know, via Twitter or via your iPad, you know, so you can start debating what's going on, discussing it. And we'll talk more about Million Dollar Drop in a minute and why I think it's worked in the UK and not in Australia. I think that can add to the experience. And then the next part is whether you can integrate that content into the actual programme. And I think that's going to be more challenging.
Yeah, there are two shows that were mentioned among delegates. Conspiracy 365, Australian shows.
And Conspiracy 365, that was just announced this week, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah, just this week. And apparently it's about using social media to make a story, give a story greater depth, greater interactivity between the audience and the viewer, which I think is interesting.
Definitely.
And apparently but the US is the market where it's happening most at the moment. And I guess at MIP, that'll be a point of discussion there.
Definitely. No, I agree. I mean, I think there's just some interesting ideas coming through. We're at the very beginnings of this now.
Yeah, MIP is next week.
Joyous Cannes, yes.
That's the big international TV marketplace, I guess. What are you looking out for there?
Well, I mean, I'm seeing loads of journalists, as I usually do, and walking them down the Croisette and getting sore feet and hopefully drinking too much and having a sore head in the morning. But the proper debate is I'm going to see lots of customers, lots of platforms. We're doing a launch there. I'll tell you why not, eh? We're amongst friends. We're launching a new strand called Video Game Heroes, which is going to be in Australia too from April the 4th. And what we're doing is basically creating a breakfast show, which is all about gaming and taking key properties like Sonic the Hedgehog and Super Mario Brothers and Donkey Kong and putting them all together with a big wrapper on, new graphics, specially commissioned music. And this will launch globally in all 96 countries we're in on April the 4th. So we're doing a launch at that.
Say breakfast show?
Breakfast show, 6 to 9. It's like my old radio days, you know. It's a kid's breakfast show before they go to school.
Wow, this is quite interesting. I can't think of a similar example somewhere else of that.
I hope not. Well, I'm trying to innovate, you know. I try and get there first. I'm sure some will copy, but for a while hopefully we'll be the only ones doing it.
And this presumably, because it's in so many territories, can't possibly be live.
No, it's not live, no. I mean, the point is what we're doing effectively is we're taking a whole load of assets and we're sort of theming them and wrapping them up. And the shows aren't identical in different markets. I mean, you know, here in Australia there's different rights availability to, you know, Africa or Europe, but it's going to be a global brand and it'll be the same philosophy everywhere with lots of interaction, you know, things to win, called Video Game Heroes Breakfast.
Well, we'll talk more about television later on in the conversation. Next, though, Kentucky Fried Arteries. We meet the double.
Now, it's the second time in as many weeks that KFC has been the topic of discussion on the Mumbrella Cast. This time, the controversy isn't so much surrounding their ads, but the new product. This week, we're introduced to the double. Think of a burger, then replace the bread buns with two fillets of chicken and between that, slap some bacon and cheese. Then throw out the salad and that's the double. The health debate has been one of the big media stories of the week. So Tim, is all coverage good PR?
This has been such a big story this week. It's one of those ones, as soon as you see it, you know it's going to be a story. I think we got a bit lucky, by the way. I've not looked, because we were the first ones to report this, and I've got to look into it to fully get there, but I think probably what happened was a press release went out under embargo that we weren't on the list for, so fortunately weren't obliged to follow. And then somebody in the office got the early email that went out to the customer base saying, here's your sneak preview of what we'll be announcing tomorrow. So that was what we wrote the story from. Now, I remember the furore from when they launched this in the US and Canada almost exactly a year ago, where it was called the Double Down. I note, by the way, that a very smart, small little burger company in Sydney trademarked the phrase Double Down a few months ago, which is why it's called the Double over here, because somebody else owns the trademark. But anyway, it's been absolutely huge this week. all of the predictable conversations around the health implications of this enormous hunk of protein. One of the arguments is, well, hey, it's good for people on the Atkins diet who are avoiding carbs. And there are other burgers out there which are even higher in calorie content. It's been a huge conversation, but an underlying thread of that conversation has been people saying, well, I'm going to go and have one of them. So for KFC, I reckon they'll be pretty happy.
Do you think there's a sense that it's almost the forbidden fruit, the forbidden burger, obviously, in this case, that the more you tell people not to eat something, the more they want to have it. The more you tell people to drive a Toyota Prius, the more they want a sort of gold-plated Hummer sort of thing. I mean, what do you think, Paul?
No, look, I agree. I mean, I've been amazed the amount of discussion. I mean, it's just everyone is talking about it. And hey, KFC have done brilliantly, because if they don't even sell this, they'll sell something else, won't they? I mean, they've just been everywhere. I do think it's extraordinary that there's been so much acceptance of it, because really, it's going to be full of fat as well as full of protein, isn't it? I mean, you know, it's almost outrageous to push something like this when in Australia there is already a problem with overweight and obesity. There's the second most obese nation in the world for children. And that here's this huge, great, you know, slab of chicken. But hey, great result by KFC. And I think you're right. Everyone wants to try one. And I'm feeling I want to try one. I know it's going to be bad for me, but I sort of want to try it.
We actually toyed with the idea of bringing them into the podcast this morning and having one each. But in the end, I couldn't quite face it. I've got to admit.
Tim, I'm very, very proud of you for not actually succumbing.
Well, the strange thing is, it's one of those, and maybe this says more about my attitude to it, but it feels to me like it's one of those burgers, if you actively make the choice to go and ask for it, on a certain extent, you're kind of saying, actually, I'd like to die.
Well, I mean, it's got, what, two sorts of cheese, isn't it, in the middle, and bacon in the middle. I mean, my God, it is a coronary waiting to happen.
It is.
But it's very much targeted to adults, isn't it? I mean, it's...
Well, men, isn't it? It reminds me of the Yorkie campaign, you know, like, Yorkie, you know, it's not for girls.
Now, this was the campaign in the UK, the York, big, chunky chocolate
big
bar.
Big, chunky chocolate. It's a bit like, if you don't have one of these, you're not a real man, you know. So, anyway, people think, oh, well, I'm a real man, I'm going to have one of these burgers.
I mean, it's
a fantastic piece of marketing.
And they've been marketing, you know, right from that email blast that went out to their database beforehand was labeling it, you know, the ultimate man food.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the things that was quite interesting about the email that went out was they had a sort of mini social media backlash, because they sent out this email, they put the message up on Facebook to the KFC Facebook group, which has a lot of fans, saying, okay, we're not going to launch it for another day, but if you go into the stores tomorrow and ask for it custom made, they'll make it for you. And there were an awful lot of comments from people saying, well, I went in all excitedly with the printout, and they had no idea. And you can just imagine these conversations going on with some surly person behind the counter. And it's unfair to visualise this, but, you know, fat nerd waving their piece of paper saying, I'd like my double, please. And you can see that happening all over the place. So lots of angry comments, of which the funniest one was the outraged one of someone saying, I walked 10 minutes to my store to get it. And then, of course, all the comments following on, well, you know, that was probably...
It's such a waste of opportunity, because had they got that right, isn't that a great thing? It's back to your point, really. Like, I had one first. Like, oh, really? You know, that would be a real conversation stopper, wouldn't it? You know, I've had one. So they should have just followed through the execution there. What a shame. Missed opportunity.
Next, who's ranking the best in radio?
The latest radio ratings from Nielsen were released this week, with Oz Stereo maintaining its strongholds in Sydney, Perth and Melbourne, whilst DMG's Nova went pretty well in Brisbane and Sydney too, and Mix FM still maintained top spot in Adelaide. DMG's classic rock very much remains up against it though. In the talk battles, the new look 2UE had a reasonably solid start in Sydney, whilst 3AW had a great trip in Melbourne. Now, Paul, in a previous life, you were a radio man. One of the big conversations that's been going on in Sydney in recent weeks has been about the art of talk radio. You know, we've seen for a long time 3AW really strong in Melbourne. More of a battle in Sydney between 2GB, which is a long way the number one, and 2UE, which, you know, is hoping to go back to its glory days. So we've reported on their generational change, the new generation of presenters, and this has been the first trip for them. Now, I was actually expecting to see the ratings fall this time around, because there's lots of new voices. So to me, the fact that they just stayed pretty much where they were is probably a result.
I think so, yeah. I mean, particularly in talk radio, because it's so much about the host, because you haven't got the songs. You know, radio station is like getting someone into your house, isn't it? It's like a new friend coming around, a new neighbour coming around, and it takes a while to get acquainted. So that's a good result for them. I mean, that would make me believe that probably next book they're going to go up.
And I think one of the things, of course, is in the Sydney market, there's such a dominance where, you know, we'll sometimes see 2GB, certainly in the 16, sometimes up to the 20. One of the other questions that people always point to is whether one of the elements is the way the survey is done. We're still in a diary system here in Australia. You probably witnessed the alternative systems and the alternative experiments in the UK, which we're just beginning to look towards now in Australia. What would your advice be to the radio industry?
Well, there is no doubt that the results you get is a function of how you actually do the survey. And I'll give you one example, which was actually Virgin Radio in the UK, national rock station, which was rebranded to Absolute Radio.
Of which the former programme controller, Paul Jackson, is now here in Australia.
He is indeed at DMG Radio, yes. And interesting to see how he's doing. Sounds like he's doing okay from the numbers you just read out. But they basically rebranded from Virgin Radio and called the station Absolute Radio. Now, most people would agree with me, I think, that the new station sounds as good or better than the old station. But despite a succession of books over 18 months, there's still about two-thirds of the audience of the old Virgin Radio. And people believe that's because of the way the methodology works. It's because of the diary system, because it relies on aided recall. And, you know, Virgin's a brand and Absolute is not a brand. So this is about brands. It's not just about performance. Brands do better in diary systems.
Why did they rebrand, just out of interest? Why from Virgin to Absolute?
Oh, they sold the station to Times of India, Times Newspapers of India, and Richard Branson was only going to give them a certain amount of time to keep the Virgin name. So they had to lose the Virgin name, and they came up with Absolute.
And then I seem to remember there was some row with Absolute Vodka.
Well, yeah, the question of whether there's an E on the end or not. One's got an E, one hasn't got an E, and they saw that one off. It's actually a very, very good radio station, and they're doing very good stuff actually online and you know, not on traditional FM AM, but they've just not got those numbers because of the research.
And I know each time you're in Australia, probably only here for a week or so, do you actually get to hear much radio sort of in your hotel room while you're getting ready to go to conferences and stuff? Or are you more of a TV watcher in the
morning? No, I do, and I participate. And yesterday I was actually on the Amanda Blair show in Adelaide, talking about healthy eating, and we did about half an hour with her via the phone. So I always, you know, try and get two or three radio interviews, and the same's been the case here. I often do the ABC, do Life Matters and other shows. So no, look, I listen a lot. I love coming here because the talk radio here is very, very strong. There's lots of formats, and I like being on it. You know, sorry, ego, but I love radio.
Now, Robert, you're also relatively new to the Australian market, having come over from Singapore. What are your early habits?
First impression, I first, in earnest, listen to radio on the way from the airport to AdTech yesterday.
This is in Melbourne.
Yes, and I was trying to listen to the radio, but the cab driver was shouting at the radio so loudly I couldn't quite make out what was being said. But to
sounds
your point,
like a 3AW listener.
Yeah, right. But to your point, what I did pick up was very interactive. People were even, and indeed this morning at 5 o'clock in the morning when I got up to go to the airport from Melbourne to Sydney, people still phoning in, even at that hour. It did strike me how interactive it was. The topic's obviously very well chosen. It was about politics, but people were willing at that hour to be quite vociferous and passionate about the topic of the day. Just on the advertising around radio, I didn't find it that impressive. Mind you, radio advertising the world over, I don't think is great. The creative quality was poor. But those two things struck me, the interactivity and the poor quality of the radio advertising.
That is an interesting question, isn't it? Yeah, the quality of radio ads, I mean, it's an old one, isn't it?
It's an old one, and it's the local ads that are always the problem, isn't it? You know, it always ends up being a shouter over a piece of library music. I don't know what the answer is. We've had this debate now for 25 years. Everywhere in the world is the same thing. The trouble is, of course, great creativity doesn't necessarily mean it's the best working ad. Sometimes those really irritating ads that you think, oh, God, I can't stand it anymore, actually can be very effective.
The latest round of the Siren Awards, which takes place every 6 weeks or 2 months or so, has just picked its winner. So we will have a listen to one great piece of radio creative.
I don't think this living situation is working out.
What?
You keep pooing on the floor.
A, it's only a poo. B, it's dry.
It's so you can disgusting. Easily get rid of it. We want you to move out.
You want me?
Yeah.
Oh, come on, loosen up. It's only...
No, you have to move out.
What, over a poo?
Yes.
Look, I really think we can make this
no.
work.
No.
I won't go on the floor anymore, please.
At Allpest, we don't negotiate with rats. Go to allpest.com.au.
That was just a little example of this month's winner of the Siren Awards. Next, we talk IPTV, the teleprogramming of tomorrow.
Also speaking at the Astra conference this week was Foxtel boss Kim Williams, who outlined the pay TV provider's priority to move to digital delivery of individual content over a mass broadcast model. He said Foxtel will launch new set-top boxes, which will enable viewers to watch internet-delivered content as broadcast material. Tim, some of this sounds like techno jargon, but what does it mean?
Yeah, I had one of the problems I had just in writing the story based on Kim's speech was trying to sort of quote him in the intricacies whilst exactly couch it in those terms of what it means. What I think the key point of his predictions was that the boxes you have now, particularly the pay TV boxes, pretty good at bringing you broadcast television, and also okay at bringing you IPTV. In other words, the bits of television that come to you over the internet, things like Foxtel On Demand, for instance. But it's going to be the other way around. They'll be first and foremost about IPTV delivered content that will also be pretty good at carrying broadcast content too. But I guess the bigger part of the picture is what it means is, if you're sitting at home, it'll be as easy to watch on your big screen telly, something that's just gone up on YouTube, as it is scheduled programming. Obviously, all of that's possible now. It's the convenience factor, though. It's not as easy for most people in most homes to stream it onto their TV screen. Yeah, some people have got the boxes and do it, but they tend to be kind of at the front end of the movement. Interestingly, he's saying that these next generation boxes will come from Foxtel within the next 2 years, which is interesting. I mean, you were at the presentation
as
well.
Yeah, I was
you?
There and I saw Kim. I think this is very smart because, look, the issue for subscription TV in Australia is it's at 30%. In the last year, they've grown subs by just 3%. That's just Foxtel and Austar. So, 70% of the population do not have subscription TV. But actually, looking at the offer here compared to around the world, it's a very good offer. It's very good mix of channels, very good mix of shows. But I think the marketing has not been maybe as good as it could be, which is why if you look at people who've got subscription TV and you compare to those who haven't, there are marked differences. If you say to people, is subscription TV better or worse at providing, let's say, children's programs? A non-subscriber will say no. A subscriber will say absolutely yes. And the same is true of all the genres with slightly different scores. So you've got people who've got it really like it. People who haven't got it just don't understand it. That's one challenge. But you've also got NBN coming and this whole new world potentially of competition coming. Who could be very, very serious threats to Foxtel and Austar. So I think Kim quite sensibly is actually laying down the first stone and saying, we Foxtel are going to be at the future of this revolution. There's risk, of course, because suddenly, as you say, YouTube becomes a channel alongside the Seven Network or My Channel or, the Style Network and is competing head-to-head. But the reality is that's going to happen anyway. Kim is saying, we're going to embrace it and we're going to make Foxtel the enabler of all this content, which means Foxtel still has got a very important role as an aggregator to customers to provide that to you. It makes it easy for you. I went to a conference in Switzerland a few weeks ago, and there was a fascinating stat where they put on the screen the reach of YouTube as if it were a TV network by various European markets, France, Spain, Germany, UK. And in all those cases, YouTube is in the top 10 channel. Now, that really does send the chill winds down people's spine when you hear that.
Now, it does. One of the caveats I should probably throw in at this point as well, because I know we did a similar exercise where we looked at the number of views that Natalie Tran, who's one of the most popular Sydney-based video bloggers on YouTube, compared to, say, an episode of Top Gear on the Nine Network. some of the people sort of pointed out that sometimes the comparison is between, you know, a 3-minute clip versus a 30-minute programme. So there are caveats attached. But if you were to draw two graphs, they'd be going in different directions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think anyone's yet going to have an evening in watching YouTube. I mean, I don't think so. I mean, you know, we're still going to want great documentaries, great dramas, great produced, professionally produced programmes. But suddenly these are now sitting alongside all of the weird and wacky things you get on YouTube. Obviously, what will be very challenging if YouTube are able to get professionally produced content on there.
And of course, they do have things like Cricket already.
They've got some things
instance,
already. And in fact, in the UK, Channel 4, who've got got an on-demand system called 4OD. The shows on 4OD are also on YouTube. Now, that is clearly a very interesting trend because obviously, if ultimately that content sits on YouTube, why do you need these other channels? And the big risk is the ABC here, who are not the most accountable organisation, you know, probably overfunded.
You're starting to sound like one of Mr Murdoch's stormtroopers.
Well, no, I fundamentally believe this, because coming into this market, what's extraordinary to me is how regulation is so pro the ABC and the free-to-air, is ridiculously so, holding back Australia. I mean, Australia is behind in digital TV because regulation is so antiquated and so counter the consumer.
For instance, do you see ABC 3 as a threat to your business?
Not at all. Look, ABC 3, its job is to put on Australian content. It's not doing a very good job at that. You know, this target they've got is an incredibly soft target. They should be really investing in the Australian creative community. That's the role of a public service broadcaster. And if they do that, fine. No problem with that at all. But the issue is that they've got to be not allowed to potentially screw up the ecology. Because what will happen is if they start putting their stuff onto YouTube, then that will damage the range and diversity in the Australian market. It'll actually be counterproductive for consumers.
Next, Clarkson and Friends miss a gear at 9.
You're listening to the Mumbrella Cast. For more on all of these stories, go to mumbrella.com.au. Top Gear was SBS's biggest show until it was poached by the bigger budgets of Nine. Less than 2 years later, this show, which is made by the BBC in the UK, seems to be struggling a bit. It debuted on Nine in February last year with 1.7 million, but fell to 647,000 this week. That's less than it was rating on SBS. Now, also in TV this week, staying on Nine, Million Dollar Drop pulled an audience of just 644,000 on Monday night, which was actually lower than the ABC's Four Corners and Media Watch, a rarity for a commercial network. Bear in mind that usually when we talk about these things, we see million as the success fail mark. On Seven, the second episode of Winners and Losers raked in 1.6 million, and then the third, which aired immediately afterwards, pulled in 1.4 million, and that's on top of its debut last week of 1.6 million. A few things to kind of untangle from the TV ratings this week. Also worth noting that as we were starting to record the podcast, the ratings came in for the last ever episode of City Homicide on Seven, and that did about 750,000 viewers, which honourable enough for a 9:30 PM time slot. But one of the things we talked about is a Million Dollar Drop, which I think is called Million Pound Drop Live in the UK. What's your sense on the difference between those two shows?
In the UK, it runs on Channel 4, hosted by Davina McCall.
Ex-Big Brother host.
And is actually a pretty good show. I mean, there's good tension there, because you end up finding you're sort of playing along, you know, with the answers and saying, oh, no, I hope they don't lose the money. There's also a fantastic app which enables you to actually play along on the website. And they then report back on the programme how people are going. And, you know, at the end of each round, they'll say, this number of viewers who are playing, you know, have lost their money, this number have got their money, this number would have made the million.
And this is working because the show is going out live.
Going out live. And that has been a very, very big influence on the ratings. You know, it really is a show where there's drama because you can play along. And then there is feedback onto the programme, you know, reported back via the presenter live. So that's not being done in Australia, and I think that might be a mistake. I don't know whether the host can make this work. I mean, certainly with other format shows, the host can screw a show up if they don't really get into the DNA of it. Davina does it very, very well. I haven't seen the Australian version, but these numbers are bad.
Yeah, so it's Eddie Maguire is the host who did turn Who Wants to Be a Millionaire into a phenomenon in Australia, and he's certainly always been the go-to guy with Nine. It's just that slight question of whether, you know, whether he's beginning to passes sell by day outside of Melbourne. Still, you know, very much associated with Melbourne. Still does the breakfast show on in Melbourne on Triple M. So very much a Melbourne identity. And I wonder whether that's an element that's kind of affecting it. I suppose the one question in terms of the live element is, of course, with the multiple time zones in Australia, it's kind of fine to do $1 million drop live or as live in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, but for the Perth audience, for instance, you've got this lag.
But what you could do maybe is you could not have the feedback live on air, but you could still have play along, you know, online. So it's always going to be correct for your time zone, just as you can't feed it back on air.
And the other issue, interestingly enough, talking about the social media thing, is I noticed this week Nine were, just through their, you know, relatively new Twitter feed, sort of, you know, going question at a time. What they'd forgotten was that they'd had a panicked extra episode last Thursday, which didn't go out in all markets. So this Monday, the episode that was being aired in different parts of the country was a different episode in Sydney to Melbourne and going out at different times. So there was all sorts of confusion going on Twitter, with Nine tweeting about the episode that clearly whoever was the social media manager running the account in Sydney was watching wasn't the one that was going out in Melbourne. So it was something of a, you know, something of a debacle when it came to the social media side of things.
Just on the popularity of $1 million drop, there's a notion at Astro, I'm not sure if there's any truth to this, but the sort of popularity of money-based shows doesn't have quite the grab in Australia because it wasn't hit as hard by the financial crisis. Whereas in the US and the UK, which have hit harder, the popularity of money-based shows has a bigger pull. I'm not sure whether that's anything.
It's a really interesting theory. I mean, it may well be. I think that the key, though, is whether there's real jeopardy, whether you actually get to care about whether the contestants win or lose. That's the key to it, I think, because as a viewer, you're not going to win the money. You know, even if you play along online, you're not going to win the money. It's just for fun. I think it's the drama. I mean, Davina McCall does a really good job at building up the tension, going to the break, and you go, oh, the break, but you stay because you want to see what's happening next. It's a drama in the way, as you say, you know, Millionaire Here was brilliant in its heyday. It's that sort of jeopardy, and you just want to sort of, you're on the edge of your seat wondering what's going to happen. That's great telly.
The other sort of signal within this that kind of emerged 12 hours after the ratings came out, the initial ratings came out, is when the 15 minute ratings came through, the show came up from third in the time slot for its last 15 minutes of the show. It won its time slot relatively easily, which suggests as the questions get a bit harder and the peril actually comes along, maybe there's some sort of possibility there for the show to be saved. Yeah, maybe it's not an hour-long show is the answer.
It may be. I mean, maybe it needs time to bed in. I mean, you know, if they've been messing about with the scheduling in different markets, you know, maybe it needs a few more weeks. Maybe they've got to stick with it and just sort of show a bit of confidence.
Well, the other show, which, again, has been under the spotlight at Nine this week, is Top Gear, which... you know, it seemed like a real marquee property when they brought it in, but has been struggling in the ratings of late. It does. I thought it had an international appeal, Paul.
Well, this week at the Astra conference, the BBC Worldwide, sponsored the lunch, and it was very nice, thank you, BBC. And they had an Anne Robinson impersonator. Apparently she does Judy Gillard very well. And we had some quizzes. And on our team, we called ourselves Media Supreme, and indeed we were. We won the prize. So I actually won a Top Gear video this week, which I haven't watched, I must admit.
Are you going to bother to put it on the plane back?
I think it will get packed and probably given some on the T-shirt. Was quite nice. Look, I think Top Gear is one of those things you could never predict would be as big as it was. It's still big in the UK. I don't know why it's doing less well here. You know, I get a sense there's still a momentum behind the show, but you know, I can't fathom this one, I must admit.
Yeah, Robin, I was going to ask you because a couple of the bits of the feedback on the comment stream this week would be, number one, too many ads. It's a show that's supplied by the BBC at about 50 or 55 minutes for the international version. It tends to be in a 90-minute time slot in here in Australia. And secondly, issues over lack of clarity over whether you're going to be watching a repeat or a new episode.
Right. Well, on the popularity, I'd sort of hazard a guess that people are coming to terms with the sort of unbearable arrogance of Jeremy Clarkson. As a presenter, well, my personal view is it doesn't quite do it for me. I'm not sure whether perhaps his popularity is starting to wane, just as it begins to grate a little bit with audience.
I wonder some of it, though, whether some of it is a slightly naive debate in that it is a commercial network, so of course it's going to show ads, and that, you know, that's how the viewers don't have to pay for their television. So whether that's just an element that people just aren't used to a reality of, you know, that's always going to face them.
Right. Yeah, a problem at Astra, maybe, Paul, that you picked on this as well, is that even on subscription TV, there's a perception there are too many ads as well. Even during programmes where there aren't any, they did a survey and they found that actually people think there are too many ads even during a movie that has no ads in them. Just one, that's a problem that medium has as well.
No, I think it does. And I think, you know, if you think about it, you know, you're paying for ABC, you're paying for the 7, 9, 10 network, but you're also, you know, you're paying clearly for subscription television. If you're paying for it and then there's loads of ads as well, you go, you know, maybe I'm slightly, you know, this doesn't work. I think there's a real opportunity for Foxtel and Astra to make more, of the fact that many channels have no ads. And as you said, I mean, think about, you know, what the volume of ads should be, you know, maybe restrict minutage, you know, structure the ads more carefully. I mean, certainly at Kidsco, we have no ads at all on Kidsco. And we did that deliberately because we wanted to offer an alternative to the free TV network. So, you know, there are parents who really like the idea. There's no ads on the kids channel. And it's a big, big plus for us.
Well, next, what Robin learnt at AdTech Melbourne. So this Wednesday and Thursday saw AdTech Melbourne take place for the first time. Robin was there. Now, Robin, AdTech's almost become a Sydney fixture. Your first impressions of the Melbourne event?
Yeah, it's pretty well attended. I guess about 150 at the event, about 75%, I guess, of the capacity of the Sydney event. Of course, the big hiccup was the lack of attendance of the keynote speaker, Bonin Bo.
That can be a bit of a pity when there is no keynote speaker in the
room.
Yeah,
I mean, he was beamed. I mean, obviously, AdTech made a big thing of the fact that he was replaced. He was beamed in live, so he was actually there. But, of course, he wasn't there to take... He was there to take questions as well. But, you know, I guess a lot of the value from a keynote speaker is being able to engage with him one-on-one during the coffee breaks, that sort of thing. So that obviously wasn't there.
This came up at Astro as well, didn't it?
The same thing happened with Jeremy Darrow, the CEO of BSkyB, and he was on tape. Last year, Mark Burnett was there, and he was live, and so you could talk to him live.
He was the guy
satellite.
Who created Survivor. And
right,
all that.
And that was fine. But I think watching an hour and a quarter of a guy on tape and then then taped questions is really not ideal.
Right, yeah. I mean, the content of what he was saying was good. He was a very dynamic speaker, full of beans. And I guess that one of the take-home points was the phrase digital fitness in the Darwinian sense. How fit digitally is your organisation? He's talking about how to break down barriers of innovation, how the sort of compulsion to experiment. And he's talking about, I've heard this phrase quite a lot recently. I think it was in a conversation with Todd Sampson at Leo Burnett, who describes his agency as always being in beta mode. He said that great companies, particularly in the digital space, are always in beta mode. Google and Apple, he describes as companies that are always changing, always innovating. So, yeah, that's I guess, the main take-home from the keynote.
Paul, you're looking quizzical.
No, I'm just thinking I better get down the digital gym a bit more.
That's maybe what it takes. Now, that is all we have time for today. Thank you to Kidsco Global MD Paul Robinson.
Great pleasure. See you soon and continued success for Mumbrella.
And to my co-host, Robin Hicks, for joining us today.
Cheers, Tim.
Thanks also to CBS Interactive for the studio. Production was by Alice Terlikovsky. I'm Tim Burrows. Toodle-pip.